Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, beginning the Lenten season with Missio Metropolis in Liverpool, Tales of Scarlet, Cardinal Pietro Foscari, and the legacy of a blissful Dominican. I'd like you to join me by going northwards from Rome to the city of Liverpool to meet a parish priest from the Liverpool Archdiocese. He's Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, who's currently serving at St. Joseph's Blundell Sands. I'm choosing to speak of Liverpool simply because it is among the 11 metropolitan dioceses across Europe launching a major evangelization drive during Lent, an initiative which is part of a continent-wide pilot scheme promoted by the Pontifical Council for promoting new evangelization in preparation for the scheduled October Synod of Bishops on the new evangelization to be held here in Rome. So stay tuned as Monsignor Fleetwood speaks to us of this Lenten project known as Missio Metropolis, the Pontifical Council's first major project since it was created in 2010. The Pontifical Council for Promoting New Evangelization has asked the Archdiocese of Liverpool to take part in a pilot scheme in preparation for the Synod, the October Synod, which will focus on new evangelization for the transmission of the Christian faith. Is this something that's already visible in your part of the world?
The Archbishop told me, maybe I shouldn't say this, he told me this in private, that he was very surprised and thought they'd made a mistake by including Liverpool in the list of the cities. But then when he met the Pope the next time, he realised that the decision came from very high up, and it was a deliberate decision. Perhaps Liverpool in England, because it has still the densest Catholic population in terms of Catholics per square mile of any area in the country, despite the fact that our population is dropping, our mass attendances are dropping very fast. But that last thing might be one of the very reasons why such a traditionally strong Catholic place, which is now beginning to experience a little bit of a crisis, and that will grow, that may be just the ideal sort of place to admit that evangelization, which happened a long time ago, needs to be redone. New energies, perhaps new forms of evangelizing. And we have had invitations from the diocesan offices to put forth anything we're doing during Lent so that we can share the good practice. And I know that's a very helpful thing, because I'm a parish priest there and I very rarely see my colleagues. We're all very busy, but we're all operating a little bit on parallel lines. We occasionally meet because we arrange to meet, but it's not enough. So if we have in front of us, either on the internet or on a document sent out from the bishop, these are the things that everyone's doing this Lent, it may be a great encouragement, because some people are imaginative and have no problem inventing new ways of presenting our faith. But other people need a lot of help. They have different gifts. So if we share, even that's just among the priests, let alone what will be done in schools and in organisations and in religious houses, I think lots will be going on. And the fact that we share the information is stage one towards understanding that there are some people already heavily committed to evangelising in new ways. And probably many of us can learn from that and gain valuable hints and help from each other.
I think people in general are a bit mystified by the term new evangelization.
Well, if you spoke Latin fluently every day, or if you spoke German fluently every day, you'd know exactly what it means. Neue Evangelisierung in German would be evangelizing afresh or evangelizing again. And it's the same idea in Latin. It's not a completely new thing. It's doing the job again. But the new thing is maybe that you find new methods or new ways of communicating. So it's not a new content. The message is very important, and that's why we are still Catholics. That's why we remain committed to the Church and the Gospel and the person of Jesus. And those things have to be central in whatever is new. You don't lose those things, but that you think, well, how can I tell more people about this? Or how can I tell the people who don't feel worthy to be in church that, you know, that's just the wrong idea. You know, the church is for you. I'm not worthy to celebrate Mass. I never will be. But I do it because I'm invited to, and it's a great privilege to me, and I know it's a strength to lots of people.
I don't live in your part of the world, but, for example, here in Rome, you get the feeling that there are a lot of nominal Catholics who go to church when they prepare for their first communion, they have their first communion, they get confirmed, they get married, and then when they die, there's a Catholic funeral. But it doesn't really go beyond that.
Yeah, I don't think that's new to anybody in any part of the world. There's nowhere that is without that phenomenon of very superficial adherence to the church. Some people don't know what it is to be deeply committed, but maybe that's exactly the challenge. We're trying in Liverpool a different way of approaching the sacraments. Previously, people my age, for example, learned most of what we learned in school. And whether that coincided with our home life was a lottery. I was lucky, at least my parents believed in it, although they didn't go to church very much. And my grandmother was at home, and she was a profoundly Christian woman, possibly even a mystic, but I was lucky. There were many people in my class whose parents obviously didn't know which end of the church was which when they came for communion or confirmation or any of those sacraments. So now the Archbishop has decided that all catechesis or preparation for the sacraments will be done with the help of the members of the family, which means a bit of a revolution and an upheaval for all the kind people who've given so many hours and years as catechists. They've got to find a new way of being not so much teachers of content, but helpful to parents in the sense of accompanying them as they, the parents, pass on what they know, and maybe feed the parents a bit more so that they know more. In the process, everybody learns. It's quite remarkable when it's done properly. But we priests and our catechists who work with us are finding it a great challenge to change the way we do things. But it's obviously the best way forward, because that way, the parents don't just turn up on the day of the celebration. They're very much part of it all from the beginning. Whether it continues after that is up to them. Nobody can be forced to do anything. And that's not the idea. But it may just chip away at the superficiality of some people's commitment and help others to deepen theirs.
You mentioned that your grandmother was a Christian, rather than saying she was a Catholic. Why did you say that?
To me, the two things aren't really very different. But as a matter of fact, she was a convert from Anglicanism. And by being converted, she was disinherited and disowned by her family. So she never saw them again, ever. She gave up everything to become a Catholic and to marry the man she met in later when she moved to Ireland. So her telling of the Catholic story was remarkable. She told me of the place she went to learn about the Catholic faith, which was somewhere near Preston, a little place called Gregson Lane. She told me of some of the experience she had of the presence of God and even the presence of the devil. And she was a remarkable lady. When she prayed, it was quite an experience to be with her. And she's the one who took me to church. She's the one who taught me that you can't really hate. It's not part of us. All these things would need explaining at great length, but all this to say she was a powerful spirit and a great influence on me, and I suspect on all her own children, two of whom went off to be religious brothers, didn't stay, but that's quite something out of six children. Then eventually I went off to try to be a priest, but she'd long died by then. But she's probably one of the main influences. But having been an Anglican, she was also very sympathetic to his thirst for the gospel in other ways of being Christians. So maybe it was the right word to choose. She was never closed to other forms of Christianity, but well aware of the difficulties we had as Catholics in Liverpool in those days. It wasn't easy to live alongside some people who didn't share our way of worshipping and were very violent in the way they expressed that to us.
Finding new ways to evangelise. It's something that's necessary. It's something that's needed because earlier on you said there was a crisis of faith, I think, if I have understood correctly, and that it's going to get worse.
I don't think I said there was a crisis of faith, but there may be one. What I was talking about was simply a crisis in the numbers of people attending church or practicing their religion. That's getting difficult. It's very funny when people want us to maintain the same level of service in terms of the number of masses we say, when there are far fewer priests, but much more important, far fewer people going to mass.
But surely that reflects a crisis of faith, doesn't it? The fact that people are not going to church.
Could do. I can't judge that unless I speak to the individuals. I think sometimes it's just a habit, a laziness, rather than a crisis of what they believe in. They just don't bother anymore, many of them. And many people are under pressure to do other things. If you have a healthy young boy in your family, it's quite likely that on a Sunday morning he'll be required to play football or be in an athletics team or play cricket at certain times of the year or judo or whatever. It's very hard for a parent to say, you can't do that. You've got to go to church. Some people manage to do it. But I think a lot of people say, no, that's part of his upbringing as well. That's part of what we want for him. So a lot of families now find it very hard to fit in the demands of all their children's lives and church. So I don't think it's a crisis of faith so much as an inability or an impossibility of organising things in a way that includes everything. Another thing is, I made a big mistake many years ago by believing it was a good thing for shops to be open on Sundays. I realised a few years ago that I'd made a dreadful error of judgment. Sunday is not special really anymore in our culture, and one of the sad byproducts that I remember being told about in those days, and it didn't hit me until I saw the effects of it, is the number of people who would lose their job if they refused to work on a Sunday. So they can't go to church unless they happen to find a mass at some unearthly hour on a Saturday evening or a Sunday evening. But that takes commitment, a special kind of strength, almost physical strength, to be able to work all day and go to church at night. Some people do it. All I'm thinking of is it's not always a crisis of faith that keeps people away from church. It's very often very difficult circumstances in their lives. I'm the last person to blame people for not coming to church, but I have to recognise how many are there in order to know how many masses I need to have in my parish or in my deanery. Or, you know, we're just being realistic at the moment in terms of reorganisation. But the older people find that incredibly hard. And yet the real thrust, as in the parable of the Good Shepherd, is not to look after the 99 who are safe, but to go after the one who's lost. And believe me, older parishioners who notice that you're going off looking for new people to come to church or trying to attract more to church, sometimes they take that as an insult. But we're here. You don't thank us for being here. Well, we can't win on that one. But the new evangelization is the action of the Good Shepherd, who's recognized that some of the sheep have wandered off. And all it would take would be an invitation or a stratagem to invite them back in a convincing way. The new evangelization isn't telling them anything new. It's just saying, why aren't those people here? Or even, I'm here, but is my faith deep enough? Do I need to relearn my faith? Do we as a parish need to relearn things, to redo things, to reorganize things? There's all sorts of aspects of this new evangelization when you think about it.
And you were listening there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, a parish priest from the Liverpool Archdiocese in England. Now stepping back in time, what with the creation of new cardinals by Pope Benedict XVI at last weekend's consistory, I thought I'd take you to the Church of Santa Maria del Popolo here in Rome, a reference point for a 15th century cardinal. He's Pietro Foscari, the nephew of the Doge of the Venice of the time. As you'll discover in a moment, it's where he's buried. This little feature I've prepared for you is part of a series by the title of Tales of Scarlet, in which historians Stella Fletcher steps back in time to bring us the stories of some of the cardinals of the Catholic Church, following a route which begins at the Porta del Popolo, once the northern gate of Rome, and ends up at St. Peter's.
For many years he was thought to be someone completely different, but he does seem, on the balance of opinion, to be Cardinal Pietro Foscari, who died in 1485. He was the nephew of Doge Francesco Foscari, the longest-serving, longest-reigning Doge in Venice. Many people know Francesco Foscari because Byron wrote a play about him, The Two Foscari, about the Doge and his son, and then Verdi turned it into an opera, I Due Foscari. Francesco here was the ecclesiastical representative of the family, and the Doge wanted to get, if not a son, then a nephew, into a high position in the church. The Doge's sons died off, and so he had to turn to a nephew, and that's where Pietro came in. And Pietro was given charge of the Basilica of San Marco in Venice. It was Primicerio. But then the Venetian state said, we want a cardinal, we want a representative at the, in the closest councils of the Pope.
Vogliamo un nostro cardinale vicino al Papa.
Vogliamo un nostro cardinale vicino al Papa.
And they said, Pietro Foscari is the man, he is a loyal Venetian. He's the real thing.
Pietro Foscari vogliamo.
Pietro Foscari vogliamo. Un veneziano leale! Fatelo vogliamo cardinale. Cardinale! Vogliamo un Papa Vicino veneziano! Papa, Foscari,
so, they said to the Pope, who was also a Venetian, Paul II, make him a cardinal. And Paul said, yes, I will, but I'll keep it secret.
Sì, lo farò, ma deve essere un segreto.
It was all kept pretty open secret. Anyway, the Pope died, and this man here was not admitted to the conclave to elect the next Pope. The Venetians have spent 6 years trying to get this man recognised. Poor Pietro Foscari, he keeps being misunderstood and neglected there. And of course, in death he has been ignored once more because he had a chapel built for himself over there beside the high altar. And when he died in 1485 at Viterbo, he was indeed brought back here and buried in his own chapel. Century, another family came along and they said, we'd like this chapel for ourselves. So they brought in Caravaggio to decorate it for them, and they turfed Pietro Foscari out. His effigy has been on its travels ever since. So it's now not attached to a wall like all the other tombs around here. It's just on a metal stand. And I've found it in a number of different chapels in this church over the years. This is a man who was ignored in life and ignored in death as well.
And our thanks there go to historian Stella Fletcher for part one in Tales of Scarlet, in which she recounts the stories of some of the cardinals of the Catholic Church, beginning, as you've just heard, in the 15th century. Finally, I'd like to mark the feast day of the Blessed Angelico, rather belatedly as it fell on the day of the consistory, that's the 18th of February. I'll be doing this with Dominican Father Robert Ombres, former Procurator General of his order, who's currently based in Oxford, in England, where his special interests in Roman Catholic canon law, comparative canon law and church-state relations were recently recognised when he was appointed the Raymond of Peñafort Fellow in Canon Law at Blackfriars Hall at the University of Oxford. But despite this legal background, while in Rome, Father Ombres did not shy away from speaking to me about the blissful Dominican from his order's glorious past. Stay tuned then as I ask him my first question. Shall we start then with 1982, when John Paul II signed the motu proprio for the liturgical cult of the Blessed Angelica? Was that a surprise to you as an order?
No, I think we'd in some sense wanted it for centuries, and that's precisely what it was. It was the recognition of a devotion, a cult, to him as a blessed, as a saint, for a long, long time. The timing could have been some years before, some years later, but that it happened, I don't think, caught us by surprise.
You're an order of preachers. Fra Angelico was an artist. Where's the connection there, and what was his special charism?
The connection is communication. One of the many mottos of the Dominican order, of which I'm a member, a friar, to give to others the fruit of our contemplation. And I think, therefore, painting, as in this case, lends itself first to being communicated, and then to being precisely the fruits of contemplation, because of all the elements of contemplation, vision is one of them, to see. And traditionally, heaven will, for us, mean the beatific vision. And therefore, for a Dominican artist, it wouldn't be a big jump to communicate through the skills he had. And it's generally accepted that Fra Angelico was a painter before he joined the order. Was already trained and already very able. The medium might have been the same, but the message changed.
So what was his message, do you think, in particular? He painted a lot of angels, didn't he? And he was known as the Beato Angelico.
This goes back a long way. I think he died in 1455. 100 years after that, another painter, but also a writer called Vasari, wrote the lives of the artists, the painters, in the same Florentine milieu which Fra Angelico belonged. And so collected lots of tradition, stories about Fra Angelico. And I suppose it was for the last 500 years due to Vasari that the name has stuck, but it didn't start with him. Angelic, different levels, I think. One, because of the purity, the holiness of his own life, which was recognized by many, and hence the tradition of his own holiness, sanctity. The subject matter, which often included angels, as you say, and many people's Christmas cards have angels, and there'll be Fra Angelico's angels, extraordinary beauty, purity, which they reflect. And angelic, because it was thought that it almost took an angel to paint the way he did, not just angels, but all the other saints. I think there are many reasons then why he was known as the angelic painter and then as the angelic friar.
You have an angelic doctor as well, St. Thomas. Is there anything that you think connects the two?
Yes. I would say St. Thomas Aquinas was called the angelic doctor, partly for the purity of his own life, extraordinary splendor of it, if you like, of his virtues, and because in the Summa Theologica, best-known work, he has the longest treatment of angels of any of his writings. And within Catholicism, there became one of the standard accounts of the angels. And as it happens, the link is St. Antoninus, Archbishop of Florence, who knew Fra Angelico personally, lived with him in Fiesole in San Marco. And all of them would have had a respect for St. Thomas as a theologian.
The Beato Angelico, also known as the blissful Dominican. Does that mean he found happiness in the monastery or in his painting? Is there anything special in it?
Again, it's two levels, I think. It's in his own life. People often commented on how he never seemed to be angry, seemed to be meek, mild, withdrawn. He belonged to the observant school of Dominicans, a movement which goes back to St. Catherine of Siena. And as it happens, he's buried just a few feet away here in Rome from St. Catherine of Siena. And St. Antoninus belonged to the same movement, it's called the observant friars. I think Vasari thinks of his art as blissful and joyful because so much of it is based on heaven and communicates the radiance and the joy which goes with heaven being beyond tears and sin, beyond the needs of repentance and of guilt.
What do you think his legacy is to us today? I mean, at the time, he was considered to be a modern painter. Now we see him as the latter part of the Renaissance and beyond. He obviously has an appeal because people flock to admire his masterpieces. Do you think they understand the spirituality?
Not completely, but then I'm not sure that the preacher expects to be understood completely, especially by non-Christians or non-Catholics. But something is always communicated of the truth being true for everyone. I would say that he was in a moment of transition in terms of art, of technique, of we usually call the Renaissance, the Middle Ages, Byzantine art. So he was innovative and traditional. I think people go for the sense of spaciousness he gives them, whether they're believers or not, the sense of transcendence, that beyond the visible and also importantly within the visible, there's a depth which isn't exhausted by the five senses. And I think he manages to convey that even to people who wouldn't call themselves Christians or believers.
Is there a particular painting that means something to you? Maybe you mentioned that you'd visited the Dominican convent in Florence by San Marco. Is there something there?
I visited San Marco more than once, and here in the Vatican in Rome is a chapel painted for Pope Nicholas V by Fra Angelico, recently restored. It was the Pope's own chapel, where only the Pope and a few others celebrated Mass. But then, of course, I've seen exhibitions, I've seen books, I've seen postcards, because his work now is scattered at least a dozen museums around the world. There's one in Britain, in London, in the National Gallery. A detail of one of his paintings, if I had to choose one to keep, is that moment, which I think you alluded to, where in heaven, in the transfigured world, angels and saints, in the light of God, almost are in a dance in a garden, because that shows us both the unity of creation at all its levels, angelic, human, plants, living things, and it's transfigured. It's what it was, but more than it could ever hope to be. And I think that communicates the joy and the desire for the things of God to me.
Do you want to add anything? What Fra Angelico means to you personally, or an episode that you'd like to connect to something, or someone?
I would mention another Florentine, Dante Alighieri. In the Paradiso, at one point, Dante refers to Beatrice, his beloved Beatrice, and he says that she is the one, I'll say it in Italian first, but it's fairly clear in the English translation, quella che m'imparadisa la mia mente, she who imparadises my mind. And that's more or less a verb coined by Dante, to imparadise his mind, m'imparadisa la mia mente. And I would say why Fra Angelico has come to mean so much to me is that he imparadises my mind. He manages to convey and make attractive and convincing the glory and the splendour beyond the suffering of Christ, the crucifixion of Christ, the suffering of the martyrs, the mess of the world in all its different forms. In a few words, mine, not his, I would say that in Fra Angelico, the disfigured becomes the transfigured, and I think he imparadises my mind.
Warm thanks there to Father Robert Ombres. And that's all I have time for today. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.